is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from Tantuck Radio Network Studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Oh, wow, I just love being here. Back in the studio, and Big Ed in the control room came out and cleaned everything up here, and it's so wonderful. It was nice, I must say, it was nice to broadcast from my kitchen with my Whirlpool Whisper dishwasher going, and I didn't even hear it, but I am happy to be back here in the studio. So it's really exciting. I have two wonderful authors. This is quite amazing. At the bottom of the hour, I'm going to be talking to an author who wrote a book. Well, it's right up my alley, and it's Jane Austen's Society by Natalie Jenner. So I'm looking forward to talking to Natalie. But right now, oh my goodness, what can I say? All I can say is, oh my gouda, moldy mozzarella. I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Tom Engelberger. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Patsy, how you doing?
Okay, great. Oh, I love you. You are so fantastic. You know, I was thinking, if we had gone to high school, I bet we would have been best pals. Because
you think?
Yeah, I think. Because, you know, this is funny. I look like a typical blonde, blue-eyed cheerleader. But I took chemistry and physics, so none of the girls liked me.
Oh, man.
and so I always hung out with the really cool guys like you, who had ideas and were smart, and I'm sure you were fun in your way, in your own way.
Now, you've got me all wrong. Those guys wouldn't let me hang out with them.
Oh, no, I'm sure
the,
that
the smart guys, they wouldn't let me hang around.
Oh, I don't believe that. It's a wonderful revenge in life that, you know, you go through high school and it's not all. It's funny. I actually hated school, but. When you come out after years and you realize that the guy who was the quarterback, has a boring job, and then somebody who wasn't perhaps the most popular kid in school, like you have, I think, out of your whole high school reunion, what I don't know which year is coming up, you have to be the most successful, the most exciting graduate.
Oh, gee, I don't know about that. You know, we have a rocket scientist.
Oh, well.
We got a guy that runs the Mars rover, so he's a little more excited than
well,
me.
Well, no, but, I don't think so. I have a feeling that you're much more interested.
You are so nice. You are so nice. But, you know, I cannot deny it. I've got a great job. Yes. I cannot imagine anybody having a better job than me. It's the best.
It's amazing. And there's so many things I love about you. And the name of the book that we're promoting today, it's just amazing. Geronimo Stilton, the graphic novel, The Sewer Rat Stink.
Isn't that crazy?
Isn't
so,
it wonderful?
Yeah, that's what I do is I draw stinky things for a living. That's my job. And it's a great job.
And it makes you New York Times best-selling person. And I mean, I'm telling you, what your reunion is coming up? What's your next reunion?
I don't want to say, then you know how old I was.
Well, but, it's coming up, and you have to be there. And I'm telling you, you're much more interesting than the rocket scientist. Absolutely.
You're very nice.
You have such a mind. You have such a great mind. And the book is fantastic. You know, and it's so wonderful at this time, you know, the kids are home. Yes. Well, it's funny, actually. In my neighborhood, I drive through this wonderful, beautiful neighborhood. And for 5 years, I've been driving to the studio. And I've never seen any kids out there. I've never seen any kids outside these big houses. And now suddenly I'm seeing that they actually have kids inside.
Oh, my gosh.
They're coming out. They're coming out of the woodworks. They're out in their yard. They're riding their bikes. They're like real people. But they need books. pencil.
Yeah, they do need books. Yeah. So throw books out the window at them as you drive past.
I am. You know, I've been really giving to some young people books because I heard the thing about them. Someone was saying that their kids are spending like 7 hours looking at their telephones. And, you know, and that's bad. That's bad because when I was a kid, I got lost in books. I mean, as I said, I was that girl who was sort of a dichotomy. You know, I read constantly. I always had a book, and it fills your life when you read.
Oh my gosh! I love TV and movies and video games, but man, I can imagine giving all of those up. If it had to be, I could say, oh yeah, okay, sure, no more of that. But books?
Books.
Give up books? No, no way. That's crazy.
Well, tell us about, you have to tell us about New Mouse City and how you, the whole story behind it, because this is going to be a book I'm going to love to promote, and I'm telling you, all you parents out there and grandparents, get this book for your kids. It's just fantastic. So tell us about it.
All right, so now I don't know if you know who Geronimo Stilton is.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so, all right. So Geronimo's been around for quite a while. Some of your listeners that don't know him, your kids probably do know him because he's huge in children's books. Now, I didn't invent Geronimo Stilton. I'm just a Geronimo Stilton fan, like a lot of other people. But because I had Origami Yoda had come out and everything, I now had, a way to contact the people at Geronimo Stilton and say, hey, maybe you guys would let me do something. And it took a while for them to figure out what I should do, but eventually they came and they said, what would you think about taking one of the books that we haven't, I don't know if you know that Geronimo Stilton is written in Italian and then translated into English. They said, what if you took one of these books that we haven't translated into English yet and we haven't published in America yet, and you turned it into a graphic novel? Well, that was like two dreams come true in one, because first of all, I wanted to work with Geronimo Stilton, but second of all, ever since back in the days in high school that we were just talking about, I've been writing and drawing comic books, but I had never gotten one published. I had been trying for years and years and years. I had never connected all the dots and gotten a comic book before. So this is it. I'm getting to do it. I'm getting to make my first comic book, and it's a really big, thick one. It's a graphic novel, and I'm getting it to do it with this character that I really love, Geronimo Stilton.
Wow. That's a wonderful story. It just shows when you have a passion for something and you go for it, like you did with wanting to do this, it's just fantastic. Because let's go back a little bit here to Origami Yoda, because I will tell you something. My house is filled with origami. My sister, when she retired, after years and years of waking up every morning, 6 o'clock, going to a nice job, but, you know, when she retired, she didn't know what to do. And she did different things. She did crocheting. And then she started, I think she saw it on PBS, where they had the origami thing, the awning out, you know, on the spaceship, where they pull it open.
Right.
And so she started making origami. And she went just origami crazy.
That is awesome. Oh, man, I'm so glad to hear that.
So we're surrounded with origami. Beautiful. She does, amazing things. And so tell us about this love of origami, because it is so good for the mind.
Well, I tell you, origami is so much fun. It's such an incredible way to have something from almost nothing. In fact, I mean, you can go to your recycling bin and see almost nothing in it, and next thing you know, you've got Luke Skywalker, or you've got a crane, or you've got a box that you can put the crane into. I mean, you can make so many different things. It's just absolutely mind-boggling what the potential is. But for some people, it's hard to get into, especially for kids. And I know this because when I was a kid, I would get these origami books, and I would be able to maybe fold the goldfish that was the first one. And the second one I would have trouble with. And then the third one would be a disaster. And then the rest of the other 50 things in the book, I couldn't even begin to do. So my mission has been to make origami that kids can make too. So when I sit down to make, like, oh, I'm going to try to make Darth Vader, it's not just about making Darth Vader, it's trying to figure out a Darth Vader that a kid will be able to make too. And so that's why the instructions in the back of the Origami Yoda books, they aren't for the greatest origami Yoda in the world. They're for the simplest origami Yoda in the world.
Well, you know, nothing is better, because my sister was doing it, and of course my boys picked it up. And if you want, if you go, now perhaps people can start going back to restaurants. And since they're going to give you paper menus that they're going to throw out anyway, it is ideal to give the kids the menus and say, make something, do something while you're sitting here. You know, don't look at your phones. The phones are away. And just give them that the menu or that kids thing that they always do with the coloring, which, you know, is boring. And just let them fold this. You say, fold that thing and make something out of it.
Absolutely. It's really my mission is to try to get, first I want kids to read the book, but then when they put it down, I want them to pick up a piece of paper and either draw something on it or fold it into something or make a comic book out of it. Ever since the quarantine started, I've been really amping up the number of how-to videos I make. So in the last couple of months, I've made how-to videos about how to start making a comic book, how to fold origami this, how to do that, how to draw Geronimo Stilton. I just want to get kids started on something.
Oh, it's wonderful. Really, I had a look at it, at what you've been doing, and this is so terrific. And that's why I want to tell parents, really, this is, you know, I was a homeschool mom, so I had the joy of having my kids 24/7 for many years. And so we had this rapport and understanding. One thing, people would always say, well, homeschooling is, you know, is it social? Is it difficult? And I'd say the one thing about homeschooling, you have to really like your kids. You know, you raise your kids so that they're really nice and interesting in order to be companions for you. And so now a lot of parents are finding that it is fun, and more people are saying, you know, this is nice, and they're actually learning more. So having something like the resources that you're giving, I think, are just wonderful.
I would love to be able to get every kid in the country to sit down and draw a one-page comic. And some of them, maybe they won't enjoy it and they'll never do something else. But I bet a lot of them would draw another one-page comic after that, and maybe a four-page comic after that. And some of them would even go on to write a whole comic book or a whole graphic novel. That was such a big thing for me as a kid, was learning how to get started. And I didn't really get started in the right way. And often I made a set too high of a bar for myself, and then I would feel like a failure. So my goal is just to get kids started, make them feel like success, and maybe they'll end up writing a comic book like I did. Maybe they'll end up doing something completely different. But I just want to get every kid making something.
Exactly. This is to be creative. As I named this this program Joy on Paper, and I mean the joy of reading, the joy of writing, and the joy of playing with paper, because I love to draw myself. I think one of the things is when I talk about, you know, those menus in they give to the kids in restaurants, and they give the crayons, and people say, well, you know, draw within the lines. And I never drew within the lines. I never even occurred to me. You know, so it's just, you can have so much fun. As you said, you can forget telephones, you can forget television, you can forget, you know, everything else. But if you have paper, pencil, and some books, you can be a very, very happy person.
Yes, you are right. You're right about that.
Well, and I just, I get such a kick out of you. So when we, let's go back a little bit. We're going to talk about Geronimo Stilton because it was, it's just so much fun. The explain about what New Mouse City is. I love the takeoff of Hercule Poirot, and I love all this stuff like moldy mozzarella. And
isn't he great?
I love that.
You can see why I fell in love with the character. He's so dramatic, and he's always yelling about cheese and stuff. So if your readers don't, or if your listeners don't know, Geronimo Stilton is a mouse reporter in New Mouse City. He's actually the publisher of the Rodents Gazette, the newspaper in New Mouse City. And all he really wants to do is sit in his office and type and eat cheese. But every time something happens to drag him into some kind of crazy adventure. And in this book, the adventure was that things started to stink. The whole city started to smell really bad, so bad that everybody in the city evacuated. The whole city is emptied out. Everybody's heading for the hills to get away from the stink. And Geronimo is left there by himself with only one other mouse, his old friend, the detective, Hercule Poirot. And so he and Hercule Poirot team up. It's almost like a buddy cop movie. They team up to track down the source of the smell, because they realize it's the only way they can save the city and get their friends and family to come back. So they track down the smell, and of course, right away, it leads them down into the sewers under New Mouse City. And the sewers are not deserted. They're full of sewer rats who are led by the sewer rat queen, Trash for Sparkles the 13th. And she has plans to rule the world and by making it smell really, really bad.
Well, I don't know. You know, before, we might not have been able to imagine a city with streets empty. Now we really get it. Yes, we can imagine this city with the streets completely empty and sewer rats taking over. Actually, I understand this happening in a few cities where they're getting quite aggressive. So the whole, I think it's actually comes out at a perfect time. It's very relatable.
Now that you mentioned it, I saw that article about the rats, the real life rats. It hadn't even occurred to me that that's what's going on in my book. Man.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying
no.
It's very relevant. It's very relevant.
Brother. I didn't realize I was writing. I didn't realize it was dystopian.
Yes,
fiction.
It was. But, it is. That's it.
Well, I got to tell you, one thing about the rats in the book is that they love to dance. So maybe we could play music and we can get the rats
dancing. Get them out there dancing. You know, it's so funny. And of course, this is, we have a takeoff here of Hercule Poirot, which of course I'm sure that they got rights to do it because otherwise, you know, we have all these lawsuits. And it's interesting for you that when you did Yoda, you had to get permission. I mean, this is a big deal to be able to use a real character as a character because, you know, if you tried to do that with a Disney character, you would have been sued and, you know, like crazy.
Right. Well, what happened with Yoda was that at first we didn't think it would work, and we were actually planning to maybe even change it from Yoda into something else, which would have been a disaster. But my editor reached out to Lucasfilm, and you sort of think that they're going to be, you know, really the evil empire or something. But it was the opposite of that. They were wonderful. They were the nicest people. And they looked at what I was doing, and they said, hey, you're doing something really cool. Yeah, give it a shot. Try it out. And, of course, we had to make sure we had to run things by them, make sure that they approved of stuff, but they were so wonderful, and I actually became friends with the people at Lucasfilm. They were just fantastic and really, really helped me make that whole series a success. They were great. So we ended up going from, like, fearing them to be like, hey, it's the Lucasfilm people.
Okay,
yay.
Listen. So you tell me that you are not going to be the star of your class reunion. I don't know where you graduated. You check it out. You get over to that class reunion and you can hand
You're
out
so funny.
You can hand out books, autograph books, and whoever. I don't remember. I vaguely remember the guy who was like, oh, the guy everybody wanted to be. And I know what he turned out to be. And so I think it's so terrific that you are just, you're amazing. You're amazing.
Both were, you were very kind.
Yeah, I would love, you know, when you have your class reunion, you contact me. I will come there and I will broadcast live from your class reunion. And we will show people that, you know, when you are in, listen, all you people out there, you're in school, middle school, grade school, high school. Look at the person who's a little bit, well, I'm not going to say different, but a little bit. He's got a lot of things in his head, and see what he can become, because he can become a major person who's dealing with Lucasfilms. For goodness sakes, you are a major success. I think you're fantastic. And as every, so I will be thinking of you every day, because as I said, I'm walking through tables and pianos and everything covered with origami, thanks to my sister Natalie, who does such beautiful work. So I will also be thinking of you every day now. And just tell everybody, what's your website? Where can they find more about you and about the book and about everything?
Oh, sure. Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you for being so nice. You're very nice. I would like to call in every day so you can boost me up a little bit.
I wouldn't mind. You can become a contributor.
So anyway, if anybody is interested, I've got a website called origamiyoda.com. And I've got instructions there for folding all kinds of stuff, all kinds of Star Wars characters, all kinds of other characters, lots of different how-to activities. A lot of them I've put up recently just to try to get kids doing something during the shutdown. And actually, if you go to origamiyoda.com right now, there's up near the very top, there's a amazing animated Geronimo Stilton book trailer. You
it's
know, like
great.
They have movie trailers.
I love it.
So they have this great animated book trailer for me now. And my favorite part about the website, though, is that kids send stuff to me. They send me emails filled with their artwork. And so I repost that artwork, and we have thousands and thousands of examples of kid-made artwork and kid-made origami on that website. It blows me away.
Well, as I said, it is just, I think you are so great. And I don't know if your real name is Tom Engelberger, but I can see having a name with angles that it was, that's a great name. Gives you a lot of, first of all, everybody must have expected you to do really, 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 really well in geometry. So, but you are a joy. And so, Tom, I want to thank you so much for being on the program today. And repeat your website again.
Oh, right. It's origamiyoda.com.
And you can find out more. Tom,
yeah, and thank you so much for having me on the show. It has been a joy to be on Join on Paper. It's been absolutely fantastic. And I'm interested in hearing more about this Jane Austen book. So
okay.
I've got to find out what happens there.
Okay. You know, maybe you'll come back. Let's have you back in July, because kids are still going to be needing to do something. So I'll have you back in July, and we'll talk more about origami and how much fun it is and how just it can expand your mind. Okay. How about that?
All right, and I'll teach you how to fold something.
Okay, perfect. Okay, bye.
All right.
Okay.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Oh, he is wonderful. Isn't he wonderful? He's delightful. We're going to take some commercials, and then I'm coming back with, oh, my goodness, Natalie Jenner, my goodness, an Austen book. What can I say? What can I say?
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster?
The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I am back. Oh my goodness, oh my goodness, oh my goodness. I have an incredible author on today. And here's what I have to say before I introduce her. Who said the person, be it gentleman or lady, who has not pleasure in a good novel must be intolerably stupid? I love that quote. That's Jane Austen. And so I'm so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Natalie Jenner, to talk about her book, The Jane Austen Society. Hi.
Hi, Patsy. How are you?
Okay. Well, it is true. It is true. Who has not the pleasure in a good novel? Everybody should have the pleasure of a good novel.
Absolutely.
Now, I have to tell you, so that right off, when I was young, my sister took me to our first library, which was McGregor Public Library in Detroit, Michigan. And I started, because I had never seen a library before, I started at the A's. I thought that's what you were supposed to do. And I started, and I got to Austin, and I stayed there quite a while.
I'm still there.
Yeah, I know. And it's so funny. I became obsessed with Jane Austen at that age. And I determined that I was going to move to England and live near where she was. I started taking jobs, babysitting jobs, working in hospitals, lawn work, paper routes. Through high school, I worked in a lab in a hospital. Saved my money. When I was 21, I moved from Michigan. I moved to England and bought a house 30 minutes from Steventon.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, a 400-year-old cottage.
Oh, we're like spirit twins. That's unbelievable.
Yes. And so when I got your, when they sent me an email, would you like to talk? yeah, like, what? What have I done? I got such a kick out of it. Of course, I was so happy I get the book before everybody else. And it's wonderful.
Thank you.
You know, so as I said, I took where she was born. That was the my where I went. Now, and I spent a lot of time walking in her footsteps. You know, she lived there for 25 years.
Yeah.
And so I spent a lot of time actually sitting under the trees that she sat under and picnicking in the fields where she picnicked. So, yeah. So it's pretty.
And I went to where she died.
you went to where she died. I was drawn to where she was born, and where I wanted to, you know, because I started reading it when I was very young, and I wanted to feel that same. I wanted to understand, you know, for people who haven't read Jane Austen, I feel sorry for them. But if once you read Jane Austen, it does become an obsession.
I mean, I think you want, it's true, because I think you want to get, you want to understand how she's done it. You want to get closer to her, and she's up there with, like, Shakespeare. So you look at someone who is as prolific as Shakespeare and had multiple stories produced and a lot of things left behind. And even now we still have questions about, did he really write that one? But with Jane Austen, she's such an enigma because of the lack of the correspondence that her sister burned, and because of the, you know, six masterpieces is a lot. And so, you know, I think you sink into those books and you just wish there was more. And her characters are so likable, especially the heroines, and you kind of feel like maybe if I met her, she would be like Elizabeth Bennet, because how else could you create her? And us writers know it doesn't quite work that way, but it is. It's very enticing.
And, of course, well, we talk about Elizabeth, Lizzie. We have this dichotomy of people who are either Lizzie fans or Emma fans. I think there's it tells a lot about people who their favorite character is.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, personally, my favorite is Elizabeth Bennet. And you?
I'm Emma.
Oh, interesting. I mean, Emma's my second favorite book. And I do love Emma for how she just owns who she is. And I think she's just a really good example of somebody who is open and able to grow. So the best parts of her are what mature. And I think, you know, I love that book. But Pride and Prejudice and Elizabeth Bennet are probably still like my first love. So I think I'm always going to love them hardest and longest.
And the more you read Jane Austen, the more you marvel. You say, how did she think these things? Such deep and insightful things about human nature, because we go through life sort of like, yeah, you know, this or that. Well, you know, we don't have this. I mean, maybe you do, but I mean, normal people don't.
No, I'm normal.
We don't have this. She understands human nature to such an extent, and as you said, I mean, she brings these people to life, and you do forget that they're characters, because the more you read. And the more you want, and the more you feel like you could walk there, and it's quite exciting. And so, how you came out with this book? Let's tell everybody how the book is set up, because the idea, the concept is fascinating. Taking, you know, forming the Jane Austen Society.
Mm-hmm. Well, the book itself is. In the tagline is very short. It's about eight extremely different people who come together at the end of World War II to try and save Jane Austen's house. That's essentially what happens in the book. It is a fictional account of something that did happen during the Second World War. There was a local woman, Dorothy Darnell. She found a piece of rubbish in the lane from the house where Jane Austen had lived the last 10 years of her life and written three of those masterpieces from scratch. And she decided we should save these relics, we should save this house. She starts the first Jane Austen Society exactly 80 years ago this month. And she starts it in the parlor of her front living room. And they can't raise money because the Second World War is raging and the British pound is taking a killing. A gentleman loses his son during the Second World War, and he comes forward just graciously as a fan of Jane Austen, purchases the house himself and donates it to the nation. A trust is set up, and in conjunction with the real Jane Austen Society, they open the museum that people can now go to in the cottage. That's what really happened. For me, my inspiration was I had been running a little small bookshop. My husband gets diagnosed with incurable lung disease 4 months after opening. It's a bit of a nightmare, and we spend a year building the store up and breaking it down at the same time. We close Christmas Eve of 2016, and I take a quiet year, and I go back to Jane Austen, because Patsy, I'm sure you can relate to this, obviously, is there's something about her works that is not only energizing, but also comforting, and like a balm. So I was really sinking myself into her, and I did a lot of reading about her, and then I went back to England, walked in her footsteps, just like you, something I had done many times before, but on this particular trip in the fall of 2017, something about that village of Chawton and getting to spend a week there alone, the way you had done when you were younger, and not with my family in tow like I usually have, really moved me and really got like deep inside me on some level, creatively, must have. And then about 6 months later, I went to my first Jane Austen Society conference because I was going down the rabbit hole of really falling into wanting to know more and more and more. And I'm in Philadelphia at this conference, and everyone is talking very well the speakers about grief in Jane Austen. And because my husband had now finally stabilized on some experimental drugs and his lung decline had sort of frozen, and we've bought ourselves time, and we still seem to have bought ourselves time, I started to feel hope again. I wanted to explore the feelings of how do you move forward after trauma and grief. And one day my daughter says, I looked up and I said, I'm going to write a book about a group of people trying to save an old house, kind of like Downton Abbey. And then she said a few weeks later, I looked up and said, I'm going to write a book about a group of people trying to save Jane Austen's house. And that's how it all came about. And I think in the end, for me as a writer, it was a chance to explore different, very different people from myself who had gone through the war, sometimes through both wars, in England, in a small village, had suffered the kind of catastrophic loss that most of us don't have to deal with. But goodness knows, with the pandemic right now, so many people are suffering on that kind of scale where many people in your lives are impacted. And I wanted to explore what comes after that, because you do have to stay engaged with life and you do have to move forward. That's what life is. So my book was a vehicle for me to also explore not just Jane Austen, but how to take that first step when life is sometimes handing you, you know, not so much good luck on a plate.
Well, you've done a marvelous job. You've created fascinating characters, and I love the way you sort of reveal them as the story continues.
Thank
and you bring them in. And well, with this, well, you've got the Jane Austen touch. You've learned some good things from her.
Kind of compliment, I'll take it.
Yeah, you know, because you do make us care about the characters. I was particularly taken with Adam.
Yeah.
I think he's the one that just, you know, it's funny. I've been, you know, talking to people now, what they're reading. Over the past 5 years, I started the program 5 years ago, so I've had really an opportunity to meet people, and they will tell me what they're reading, and it is wonderful when you find somebody who says, you know, I'm reading this author and I'm reading every one of his books or every one of her
mm-hmm.
books,
mm-hmm.
Because you can see that they've gotten this connection, which is so important.
And do you think it's the connection to voice? Because I think what I love most in writing or in a particular book by a particular author, I think for me it usually starts with voice, just the sound of them in my head. And I find that's what attracts me most, probably more than plot even.
Well, you know, just going back to Adam, that he reads and that, you know, that he feels what Jane Austen is trying to say in her books and does say in her books. I thought, you know, that was a wonderful character. So tell us about the other characters, though, just briefly.
So the characters being very different. Adam opens and closes the book for a reason. He is all of us, I think, because I think most people have a more introverted energy than they might socially explore or portray. So I think Adam is a very relatable character for everybody. Everyone tells me that he's one of their favorites. The other characters, primarily there's a village doctor, Dr. Gray. He's widowed. He is frozen in time. He's living 7 years earlier with the memory of his wife. And there is a solicitor who has grown up with Dr. Gray, and he has not moved forward in life as well. He had fought in the First World War. And there's a local servant girl who has had to leave school at too young an age, and she goes to work in the Great House, which is based on a real building in Chawton, which was the house that Jane Austen's brother managed to inherit by being adopted officially by a childless couple. And he has this huge estate that includes the cottage where Jane Austen ended up getting to live with her mother and sister. And the servant girl in my book goes to work in this great house, and she discovers the Knight family library, and she starts to secretly catalog it. And she's a very precocious academic child, and she's one of my favorites as well.
Oh yeah,
she's
well,
working,
anybody
yeah,
who loves books like that.
I know, right? She's me when I was young,
yeah.
And my daughter. She's working for an heiress, Frances Knight, who in my book, not in real life, the Knight family has been completely fictionalized since about 1860 in my story, but in my book, Frances Knight is the last remaining heir to the Knight estate, which is going to become quite pivotal in the fortunes of the society and their ability to save Jane Austen's cottage. And then there's a local school teacher who is a war war widow fairly early on in the book. And there's also a Sotheby's auctioneer, because I have an homage to Kelly Clarkson in my story, which is that in real life, Kelly Clarkson had acquired the topaz ring at auction at Sotheby's that belonged to Jane Austen. And something about that story really resonated with me. She ended up gifting it to the museum through a really fascinating process. But in my final character, the Hollywood film actress, Mimi Harrison, she is a bit of homage to great trailblazers of Hollywood, like Katharine Hepburn and Elizabeth Taylor and Ava Gardner, but also to the ability after the war, when the American dollar was quite strong, with American fans were incredibly important to the salvation and preservation of a lot of the artifacts that were starting to move about the world. And I wanted to pay homage to that with an American character. Oh, I'm Canadian, and Canadians have actually had quite an involvement as well. But Hollywood's a bit more exotic.
Well, altogether, all the characters are fascinating, and you've wrapped them all in this wonderful story about Jane and the importance of saving her work and saving every little bit that we could of her, because it was terrible that, things just got torn down and people didn't realize, my gosh, I don't know how much she paid for the topaz ring, but, things are, boy, oh boy, it's fascinating. And, one of the things that I tell people, writers today, everybody does everything on the computer. There's nothing going to be a piece of paper worth any money. It's terrible that authors don't write things out by hand anymore, because those are valuable.
Yes, we don't have a record, and we don't have letters anymore. So we don't have the record after the life as well, the way we do.
Exactly.
We'll have video. We'll have other things.
Yeah, but there's nothing like the written word.
There's nothing,
the great historian Margaret George, who wrote Henry VIII and Cleopatra, she wrote her first book, Henry VIII, which is 985 pages. She wrote it by hand.
Wow.
And she still has it. I said, I hope. I said, where is it? And she said, it's up in the attic. I said, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
I said, do you know how valuable that thing is? Because there won't be any of this. I mean, like people go crazy, for F. Scott Fitzgerald. You go to Princeton and all of his work is there. Mm-hmm. And people, people write dissertations like crazy. I don't know how many people got PhDs writing dissertations on his work, but it's preserved. And so today, I think one of the nice things about seeing the original writing is to see where the revisions were made.
Absolutely, yeah. And how little or how much.
Exactly.
Right? Every writer has a different approach.
Exactly.
I mean, that's the thing, you know this so well, is that every writer's process is unique to them. And that's why the books, when they work, are unique and special as well.
So tell me more about what you saw, what you saw at the museum, what really, took your breath away.
Question. Yeah, so when you go into the actual cottage where she lived, not the great house, but the smaller building, it's right in the junction of the road to Winchester and the road to London. And if you go into the parlor where she sat and wrote, there's a little round table there, the top of which is real. I believe the pedestal base is not, but the top is the original desktop or tabletop that she wrote on. It's so small. And you see it and you realize she had a balance. I mean, some of these books are over 400 pages, Emma Mansfield. So you see that she had a kind of balance on this, tiny little round spot. And there's a squeaky door to that room that when people would open it, it would alert her, and she would kind of slip the page under the blotter. But she's right by a window, and you look out the window at the junction of these two roads, and you can see that she could see everything going on in town. Who was coming, who was going, who was off to London, who was off to church. It was really, I find that view and being able to, that's when I most feel like I'm in her footsteps. And that really, really resonated with me. And I think my other favorite part of Chawton and from my trip was where the great house is down the lane. When you first approach it, it's Elizabethan home. I think it's 1500s. beautiful. And it's facing the street perpendicular, so you get this majestic view, and you walk up this long lane towards it. And to the right, there's the Church of St. Nicholas with a graveyard. It's up on a little incline overlooking some fields, and it's just one of those really special small British parish church graveyards and churchyards, and it's got beautiful trees and shade, and it's incredibly peaceful. And I remember when I was there, finally feeling a little at peace with my life, because my sense in that churchyard was this strong sense of the history around me and the beauty and the memory of Jane Austen and her family, and the Knight family staying in this village. They're still descendants there. And I felt the weight of history and its promise, and the fact that, you know, I was both small in the context of that, but that I still had the gift of time. And I really think I took from that moment in that churchyard such creative inspiration, and that when I did sit down 6 months later to start writing my book, the very first image was of Adam on the same stone wall in the same churchyard where I had lain the previous fall.
You know, well, I think that's why Adam just grabbed me. The minute I read that, I was like, yes. And as I said, of course, I spent a lot of time at her childhood home.
I've never been to it. I'm so envious.
No. Oh,
well, the village. The house isn't there. But
no, the house, you know, isn't there. Yeah. The house is that was opposite the church. Did you?
Yeah.
You haven't been there?
I haven't.
Oh, you have to go there. Because
I know. I've been to, you know, Bath and Lyme Regis, and you know, but I haven't gone to
that's a different area.
Yeah.
Where she lived, and you know, she lived there till she was 25. It's nothing's changed. Except the house, they knocked down the original house, which is opposite the church where her father, you know, would preach. Inside the church, you can still go inside and sit there. You can sit in her pew, and you can go. Her oldest brother planted a tree there, a lime tree, and you can picnic under that lime tree.
And
there's also another tree. It's a yew tree, and it should still be there. It's been there for, it was 900 years old when I was there. And you can have a picnic there, and you're walking, and particularly it's at this, well, it's this time of the year, April, May, spring, and the flowers are all over the place. The wildflowers are all over the place. To walk there is quite amazing. It's like one of the only places, you know, you can actually like lay in the flowers. It's just, it's quite amazing. And so people, once we start being able to travel again, if you ever want to, you have to go there, because the lanes, little crooked lanes, still dusty little lanes. They're not even paved over.
That's fantastic.
It's amazing. And, you have to go there too. Because you've done now that you've done this book, you'll probably become, well-known and famous. And, of course, I'm sure that they're going to pick it up and option it for a film if they didn't already. Or did they? Are you making an announcement?
No, I'm not making an announcement yet. There's interest. Just kind of, you know, it's such a difficult time in the industry as well.
Oh, yeah, it is.
But, you know, it's definitely filmic. And then are you aware of the audiobook narrator?
No. What?
Yeah. So the audiobook narrator, he's currently in the Netflix series The Stranger, and he was in a famous BBC period drama called North and South, and his name is Richard Armitage, and he has done a beautiful, beautiful job on the audiobook, which was co-produced by both my UK and my US publishers. So I needed a British accent, and Patsy, I wanted a man. I wanted a male narrator because of people like Adam and Dr. Gray, because I wanted also to kind of reclaim the fact that historically the fandom for Jane Austen had often been most persuasively men in academia, men in positions of social power, like a lot of Supreme Court justices in North America, and well-known lawyers. And, you know, I wanted to kind of convey that with the society. So from the start, I only knew three things. I was going to call it the Jane Austen Society. There was going to be 8 to 10 characters, and I want them to be exactly half men and half women. So I was thrilled that my audiobook narrator
I will get it. I will listen to it. And Meanwhile, I know that once this is over, I'm sure that Kelly Clarkson or somebody in, you're going to get a deal that because this is going. This is it reads like a, I used to write scripts, so I know that I could take this book and have so much fun with it. So some script writer is going to be very, very happy. You know, it's painful for the author sometimes because you understand that some script writer is going to take your 306 pages and cut it down to 118 pages of dialogue. But it will be a beautiful film because you, whoever gets this to write the script, will visualize it because you've written it so beautifully. So I want to tell everyone, The Jane Austen Society by Natalie Jenner is available wherever books are sold. Do you have a website you want people to go to?
Sure. It's my name, nataliejenner.com, and I have all sorts of things on there, and there's a resources tab as well that has some information and more background from my actual historical sources for the book.
Okay. Well, Natalie, thank you so much. That's my sister's name, too. A beautiful name.
My mother's name is Patricia as well, so there
okay.
you go.
Great.
Thank you so
well,
much.
We're connected. I feel we're connected through Jane Austen,
Absolutely.
Our love of Jane Austen. And I will continue to promote this book every time I talk about Jane Austen, which is quite often. I talk about her almost every other program. So, you
know. My goodness. Thank you so much for all your time today, Patsy, and please stay safe and well.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Natalie
Bye.
Jenner. Oh, wonderful. The Jane Austen Society. Whoa, what a book. What a book. It was unexpected. I wasn't sure how she was going to go about writing this book. Very clever what she did. Eight people trying to save Jane's home. And it's beautifully done, really beautifully done. And she did learn a lot. And I will give you one more Jane Austen quote, and it's from Pride and Prejudice. And she writes, "I declare, after all, there's no enjoyment like reading. How much sooner one tires of anything than a book. When I have a house of my own, I shall be miserable if I have not an excellent library." Well, I have an excellent library. As I mentioned, I don't know, I've got thousands of books. I have so many books. I mean, I have so many libraries. I turn every closet. I turn the utility room. I have all these sub libraries, like wings of my main library. My bedroom's a library, my living room's a library, and all these little tinier specialist libraries. But it's just wonderful, and it's absolutely true. Please help your family and friends and everybody to get into books, because while we're stuck in the house, this is the time to be reading. And to take Natalie's book as an example, well, it'll keep your mind busy and you will really enjoy it. And of course, Tom Engelberger, what a guy. Oh, my goodness. Origami Yoda is a fantastic, fantastic website. You must go there, Origami Yoda, and you will love it. Meanwhile, remember what I always tell everyone. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or if you're very, very lucky, a series on the Hallmark Channel, which I'm hoping for both, I'm going to say for both Rita Moreau and Carol J. Perry. So everybody, get a book. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. He keeps everything here so safe and clean and beautiful. Everything shiny. Thank you, Ed. And he saluted me and I saluted him. Everybody have a wonderful weekend. Get a book. Take Jane Austen's advice and read and find that joy on paper that I'm always talking about. Bye-bye now.